Welcome back to Asia Pacific Perspective. I'm one half of your dynamic duo of co-hosts, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com.
And I'm Brock West, the other half of apparently a dynamic duo from APPerspective.net. And James, we are in March now, and about the second or third week of March. And of course, that means the anniversary of the Japanese earthquake and tsunami has come and gone. We will get to that in our second segment, but first, we wanted to cover a very important development that's taking place right now, and we will take this one from channelnewsasia.com with the headline reading, Australian Government to Consider Joining China-Backed Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. Australia expects to make a decision within weeks on whether it will seek to join a China-backed Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the Prime Minister Tony Abbott said on Saturday, March 14. Australia's decision on whether to become a founding member of the institution risks upsetting either key strategic allies in the United States and Japan or top trading partner China. However, Britain this week said it has sought to become a founding member of the AIIB because it was in its national interests, making it the first Western nation to embrace the institution, which would finance infrastructure projects in the Asia-Pacific. Our position all along has been that we are happy to be part of something which is a genuine multilateral institution such as the World Bank and such as the Asia Development Bank. What we are not prepared to do, however, is sign on to something which is just an arm of one country's foreign policy, Abbott told Sky News, and I almost choked on my Vegemite sandwich when I heard that one, James. We're looking very carefully at this and we'll make a decision in the next week or so. I would like to think that it is possible for this to be a genuine multilateral institution, and I think it could well be an important part of bringing China fully into that international community. 21 countries were represented at the announcement of the bank last October, and China said earlier this year that the number of founder members had risen to 26. But Japan, Australia, and South Korea are the notable absentees in the region, having held back ahead of the March 31 deadline, with Australian media stating that Washington had put pressure on Canberra to stay out. Also, it's worth mentioning, James, that just recently France, Germany and Italy have all agreed to follow Britain's lead and join this AIIB infrastructure bank over the last couple of days. So am I right in thinking that much of this finger-wagging and disapproval by the US is just a bit of grandstanding, when in reality America, Europe, China, Russia are much more similar than what's commonly perceived, especially when it comes to financial institutions? If there's one thing we know about modern-day superpowers is that they're good at setting up these large, monolithic banking structures for all their bankster buddies to orchestrate behind. So, James, you've got BRICS, the IMF, and now the AIIB. Are they all pieces of the same pie, or is there much more under the surface that's worth keeping an eye on?
Well, speaking of China and the New World Order, speaking of three-dimensional chess, this is exactly what we see unfolding right now. And there are elements here of different groups that are vying for different positions in that New World Order global financial structure. And I think that those interests are opposed, but at the end of the day, they're going for the same thing. I mean, it's just a question of who's going to control the global pie once the global pie is consolidated or baked together. So I think there are genuine elements of the American oligarchy that is concerned about what's happening with the AIIB, but only because it's not the type of global structure that they want to build. It's the same thing at the end of the day, though, at the end of the day. So, take a look, for example, The Economist just had an article up about Britain joining this AIIB as a founding shareholder, talking about, you know, how really important this is. And I hope people do take a second to actually reflect on this story, because I think there were some tectonic shifts going on here. And the Financial Times, the Rothschild mouthpiece, quoted an anonymous American official as saying that America is wary about a trend toward constant accommodation of China, which is not the best way to engage a rising power. Very interesting statement, especially because, as The Economist notes, cynical Britons might point out that that strategy worked well enough a century ago when Britain was the incumbent power and America was on the rise. But that is not an analogy that will go down well in Washington. Or at any rate, in that two-dimensional chess game where there are actual nation states that are vying for power. But as we know, as we've talked about before, there's a three-dimensional structure here where the oligarchy doesn't give a flying you-know-what about any individual nation state. They are looking to consolidate the global pie. The AIIB is one example of how China China is putting their foot into that door jam and trying to wedge their way inside. The CIPS that I wrote about recently, the SWIFT alternative, is another aspect of that. The new development bank and the contingency reserve agreement that they've signed, the World Bank IMF copies that China has just put together with the BRICS. All of these are competing globalist institutions, but let's not forget they are globalist institutions. So you're exactly right to point out that at the end of the day, it's just a question of who's going to be in charge of this superstructure. And myself personally, I don't want any of it. I want to decentralize as much as possible.
Exactly right. It is interesting to see the particular issues and topics that the superpowers that shouldn't be tend to align themselves with. Obviously, towards the end of last year, Obama and President Xi Jinping signed the climate change, this ratifying climate change agreement. And of course, you still have the TPP, which is rumbling on. Things are really being locked up at quite a pace here in the Asia Pacific. And just quickly, James, in regards to that Prime Minister Tony Abbott's remark about what Australia is, when Australia is not prepared to do is to sign on to something that is just an arm of one country's foreign policy, my simple question to him would be, then explain the ANZUS Treaty for me. And for those who don't know what the ANZUS Treaty is, it's basically a treaty which essentially binds Australia and New Zealand to any military operation around the world that the United States is involved in. And as we know, 99% of the military operations are dictated by foreign policy. So take that for what you will. James, we will move on to our second story. And as I said, we will shine a light on Eastern Japan and the ongoing saga at the Fukushima nuclear power plant. We take this one from the LA Times, and after 4 years, Fukushima nuclear cleanup remains a daunting and a vast task. Shijio Karimata is in charge of the work here at an excavation zone about 12 miles north of Fukushima Daiichi. He's part of the most extensive and expensive nuclear cleanup ever attempted. The scale and complexity of what Japan is trying to do in the aftermath of the 2011 meltdown at Fukushima is mind-boggling. Decontamination plans are being executed for 105 cities, towns, and villages affected by the accident. Many Japanese regard this massive undertaking as a solemn obligation to right a terrible wrong. Others, however, even some of the people directly affected, question whether it's a quixotic waste of resources. Decontamination activity is endless. The huge amount they are spending, maybe it would be better spent on helping residents resettle elsewhere, says Iwa Hoshi, a former city official in Minamisoma. Unlike tsunami victims whose homes were ruined and realized they had to move on, he says, many radiation evacuees are stuck in limbo, knowing that their homes are still standing. After the disaster, Hoshi coordinated shelter programs but quit government life after his bosses asked him to resume his duties in the tax department only 1 year later. Sometimes I think that the decontamination project is run by the sales department of general contractors, he adds. Karamata adds, some people have already given up. I don't think most people will come back. After the evacuation, many people wanted to return, but it's been 4 years now, and now it's maybe half. The longer it takes, the more numbers that will continue to reduce. So, James, another year passes by, and I always hope that people at the end of the day will remember the human aspect to this whole horrible catastrophe. Sadly, tens of thousands of people affected are still struggling to rebuild their lives in eastern Japan. And anyway, meanwhile, the Japanese government main priority seems to be building up Japan's military force, signing defense pact after defense pact. Strong arguments can be made about the criminal actions, of the government and of TEPCO, but yet they remain in charge of the recovery efforts. So what are your feelings on this 4 years on, James? How does one approach such a scenario from, an anarchist, voluntarist point of view?
Well, that's a very good question, because, of course, this is a problem that has been created by the nexus between the nuclear industry and the state, which, again, the nuclear industry wouldn't exist without the state because it is not profitable. It could not be profitable if it was left without the all of the ways that the state grants the licenses and what happens in order to create these nuclear power plants. So I think the real question is, get rid of the state, get rid of the nuclear industry itself. The only reason it exists is for production of nuclear weapons. But let me give you the Japanese cultural perspective on this, because whenever I talk about this, people are always surprised when I say that I've never had a Japanese person ever approach me or spontaneously start a conversation about Fukushima. It just isn't talked about. And people are usually surprised at that, but they really shouldn't be. I think this is an example of a cultural phenomenon that we've seen, unfortunately, before in the past. When you talk about the people who were affected by the atomic bombings in Japan, there was a stigma, and to a certain extent still is, over those people for decades, where a lot of them tried to even hide the fact that they were hibakusha, people who had been affected by the atomic bombing, because they were often treated as if they were kind of, you know, diseased in some way and had to be, you know, basically shunned socially. So there has been a stigma like that in the past over those people. And in a similar way, I think you see a sort of stigma, if not a stigma about Fukushima, at the very least, and I think there is some aspect of that, but at the very least, I think there's a cultural tendency to want to just sweep all of that under a rug and not look at it, because, you know, that kind of disturbs people's opinions or ideas about the country. So what we've seen is basically people trying to ignore what's happened there. And interestingly, I saw a lot of the four-year anniversary coverage here is not so much about Fukushima, the nuclear plant. It's more about the tsunami, about the earthquake, about the disaster in general itself. And, oh yeah, the Fukushima thing's still going on. So I think that's the way that the Japanese people want to see this. And it's exceptionally sad because, as you say, the excluded element here is the human element, where you have the government spending tens of billions of dollars on this cleanup and decontamination theater that they're doing to try to make it, you know, look like they're doing something. Meanwhile, there are still tens of thousands of people who have been evacuated, whose lives have been completely disrupted, who will probably never be able to return to a safe home at any rate, although they will probably be ramrodded in there in the next few years as the government declares it safe to return. And it's a compounding disaster, because not only are those tens of billions of dollars being spent on this decontamination theater, of course they're being spent, as that article indicates, towards the corrupt type of, you know, construction industry here, which is all organized crime and retired police officers, which is pretty much the same thing. And on top of that, you have the idea, well, these tens of billions of dollars could be being used to actually help these tens of thousands of people whose lives have been completely shattered, but of course they're meanwhile engaged in lawsuits trying to get the compensation they've been promised by the Japanese government and TEPCO. So it is a compounding disaster in so many ways, and the big Japanese tendency is to basically just pretend that it's not really happening, there's not really an issue there, let's forget about it. And to top it all off, Fukushima recently has said they want to be one of the sites for softball at the 2020 Olympics, so, or baseball, or whatever they end up playing. So yay, you know, Fukushima is going to be front and center in the 2020 Olympics, potentially.
Yeah, and to also add another straw onto that camel's back, you've of course got the newly passed Japan secrecy law, so even if anyone, any reporter or independent journalist out there did want to continue to cover what's really going on with Fukushima, they do have that to run up against as well. So there's these layers of kind of layers in the way of really getting any kind of clearer solution to the whole crisis since 2011. So just quickly, James, I'll blast through a couple of other headlines that are posted up to your own FukushimaUpdate.com. Purification of contaminated water to be delayed again by a year, says TEPCO. Fukushima soil transfer begins in Okuma. This is, of course, some of the radioactive soil that has been continuing to build up all around the Fukushima site and the evacuation zones. So basically they're going to throw it into a facility for 30 years and deal with it then, I guess. And just in a flashback to 2011, James, understanding the power structures behind the 311 Fukushima nuclear disaster, it's an interesting read from AsiaPacificJournal.org, and I would just going through the backstory, pretty much from World War II to where Japan is now in terms of its nuclear industry and the nuclear regulatory and how all that, you know, plays into this whole ugly charade. But for our third and final story, James, we will take this one from the Asian News Network and focusing on a country we focused on last month, but in kind of a different way. Vietnam's super wealthy, likely to get richer. Vietnam's number of ultra-high net worth individuals, UHNWIs, people who have $30 million or more in total assets, is set to double by 2024, according to the 2015 Wealth Report by Knight Frank. Last year, the population of UHNWIs in Vietnam grew to 116, six higher than in 2013. The country's rich population was deemed the quickest growing in the world. It's set to increase to 159% to about 300 by 2024. Vietnam is followed by Indonesia with 132% growth, and the Ivory Coast, which I found surprising, with 119% growth in these UN ultra-rich individuals. According to the report, the global UHNWI population last year was 172,850. Their wealth totaled 20.8 trillion. At the top of the wealth tree, 53 individuals became billionaires last year, pushing global membership of this exclusive club to 1,844, an 82% rise from that number recorded in 2004. Asia, interestingly, took over North America as the region with the second biggest UHNWI growth. Some 1,419 people moved past the $13 million mark in Asia last year. The number of UHNWIs is continued to increase last year, despite weak global economic growth due to political tensions, plunging oil prices, and the withdrawal of fiscal stimulus measures in the United States. James, I'm guessing the increasing number of these super rich individuals didn't get there by selling lemonade on the street. I'll take a wild guess and think that about 80% of them, at least, that's conservative, are either from the defense, finance, or energy sectors, you know, and they have all the ways and means at their disposal to funnel profits into their already deep pockets. So you brought this one to my attention, James. Is there another angle you wanted to take with this other than the super rich are getting even richer?
Well, I think that is the point, and there are a couple of ways of looking at that. I mean, one way is to note that it doesn't really matter what political structure is on a country. Once they start to basically come online with all the global institutions and play ball with the global financial networks, you can be capitalist, staunch capitalists, or socialists, or communists, or whatever, you're going to start seeing the exact same things happening. Exactly as you say, whoever's in those centers of power and has those connections are going to become very wealthy while everyone else remains at the bottom of that pyramid and gets proportionally even lower on the pyramid. So that's a phenomenon that is worldwide and always happening, and happening in Vietnam as we speak. And of course, one of the sickest parts of this is those handful of millionaires and billionaires who are snuffling up all of the potential benefits of a growing Vietnamese economy to themselves, they'll still be factored into those overall GDP and all of those types of numbers to say, look, Vietnam, it's taking off, the economy's doing great these days, when of course most of the vast majority of the population remains basically down at the very, very bottom of the pyramid. No surprises there, unfortunately. Another interesting aspect of this story is that as this article goes on to note, Asia generally is developing at a faster pace than the Western economies. And this is a phenomenon that isn't new, it shouldn't be surprising, but it's one that's been noted a lot of times before, and I think is related to our first story today about the AIIB and the growing influence of China and other institutions like that. And let's just throw a callback to that World Bank, former World Bank president and perennial insider, or James Wolfensohn, who gave a speech several years ago about the big shift that was coming, and if his children were growing up today, he'd tell them to be learning Chinese and things like that. And that's an interesting speech, if for no other reason than the fact it's a lengthy, detailed academic speech by a former World Bank president that has nearly 100,000 views on YouTube. So, I think people see the writing on the wall. We understand what's coming. We are being engineered into this world where China is going to be the nexus of Asia, which is going to be the rising economic juggernaut of the 21st century, and we all know where this story ends up going, because it's the same thing as Germany rising in the early part of the 20th century, and we all know where that ended up going. We are being engineered into conflict. There is going to be a conflict coming, so get your crash helmets on, and unfortunately, again, if you're at the bottom of the power pyramid, you're probably not going to be climbing up until we fundamentally change this structure of crony collaboration, which is ultimately the only political structure that exists anywhere in the world.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the next question that always comes to my mind, I'm sure to the viewers' minds, is, I mean, you pointed out we've seen this time and time again throughout history. What do we do about it? You know, I mean, what do you think? I mean, what can we do about it? I mean,
yeah, well, exactly as we've talked about before, the only power that we have is to affect what we end up doing with our lives. We don't tend to be in the positions of power to stop this big geopolitical charade that's going on. The only thing we can do is to withdraw our power. And that was withdraw our power and our energy from this system that's being created. And that was the fundamental underlying point of my presentation in Acapulco, that the entire system relies on our participation. Non-compliance is not just a vague idea. It is a very real thing that people have been writing about and talking about and screaming about for hundreds of years. And until we actually start to take responsibility for our own lives and withdraw ourselves and our energy and our time and everything from the system, our money, everything from this system, and start plowing it into the community actions that we continue to talk about as being the only real structures that should be existing, until we start doing that, I don't think that we have any chance whatsoever of derailing this overall agenda. So by all means, keep driving your gas-guzzling cars and eating fast food at fast food restaurants and shopping at Fortune 500 companies and buying cheap plastic goods made in China, and you will be contributing to this new world order. Or you can start getting off the grid and starting the community organizations like we're attempting to do in our own lives. And it's this long, slow, hard road to hoe. But, you know, unless we do it, nothing's going to change.
Just imagine, if you will, instead of an 82% rise in the amount of billionaires around the world, an 82% rise in the amount of people that are starting, at the very least, learning how to grow their own food. That right there, it completely blows away that argument of, well, there's nothing I can do about it, so there's no point trying anyway, I might as well just let it happen. Just imagine that for your will, and that, you know, that's where I draw my inspiration from. You know, when I go down to my community garden, and just speaking on that quickly, James, I have just posted up a new community garden journal entry. Please, once again, thanks to everyone for the overwhelming support and positivity I've received for it. It's great, and I'm really humbled and excited to see other people doing the same thing. It's great. This is the way to do it.
Awesome stuff. Well, I'm looking forward to more of those updates and everything else on APPerspective.net. As it continues to spill forth there, again, so much developing here in the Asia-Pacific region. It is exceptionally important that people keep their eye on what's going on here, as we will continue to do month after month. Brock West, thank you again for three very important stories.
Always a lot happening around here, James. Let's do it again next month. See you then.